As an introduction, what I'm proposing to do, and if you've had a chance to quickly scan through the short paper I've written, what I'm proposing to do is to give you some examples of some recent experience I've had with commercial arbitration proceedings, basically in the building construction area, and in particular for those members of the audience that, because I notice a lot of people here are arbitrators or other senior people, so I may be preaching to the converted, but for those members of the audience that are more at the coalface, I'd certainly encourage people to ask questions either during the course or at the end. Based upon some of the examples I've given, if they want further information about any particular aspect. As an introduction, I've been doing building and construction arbitrations and various those types of arbitration disputes for over 15 years. And in that time, I've seen exactly what David Levin identified happen. Namely, I can recall when I first got involved as a young barrister running arbitration proceedings that they tended to be run exactly like a court proceeding, in, other than the fact that you were before a judge. In that sense, during the last part of the 1990s, you'd regularly see building contracts where you're in a standard form contract because parties didn't want to go through an arbitration proceeding. You'd regularly see the pen put through the entirety of the arbitration clause on the basis that people preferred to go to court. Now, from my own experience, that aversion to the arbitration procedure is now gone. And in fact, if you do look at most of the contracts, whether they be standard form contracts or specific special purpose contracts that are drafted for the major infrastructure projects in Australia that are going on at the moment, most of them contain expert determination provisions or arbitration proceeding provisions because parties have realised that arbitration or other forms of alternate dispute resolution are in fact the preferable way to go in terms of getting a prompt and efficient resolution of a dispute. There's also the benefit, of course, that in an arbitration proceeding, it is a confidential process, and quite often parties prefer, Gina Reinhart being a good example, parties prefer to have their disputes heard in the first instance in private. One of the other benefits of the arbitration proceeding or procedure is that, in my experience again, arbitrators these days are far more accepting of a flexibility in approach so that you don't have statement of claim, defence, discovery, all the usual procedures that you have in a normal court proceeding being slavishly adopted in the arbitration process. Rather, that arbitrators are far more receptive to adopting an individual approach that may well result in a matter being resolved in a far shorter period of time. Now, in the paper I've prepared today, there's a number of points that I make in relation to what a person involved in an arbitration proceeding ought do to seek to take best advantage of the process that's available. One of the first points I make is in relation to the choice of an arbitrator. Now, a lot of arbitrators are either senior barristers or ex-judges, and there are also arbitrators that come from an industry background. Now, from my perspective, often it's there are issues in dispute that are far more technical in terms of being construction-related or technical in an engineering sense, rather than necessarily strict legal issues that are suited to people of a legal background. Now, I can think of two recent examples of cases I've been involved in where the benefit of having somebody with an industry background has resulted in a very flexible approach being adopted to the resolution of quite complicated technical issues rather than legal issues, which has benefited the resolution of the dispute in question. So the first point I make in relation to arbitration proceedings is it's important when you're choosing an arbitrator that you make sure you choose an arbitrator that's suited to the resolution of your dispute. That will not always be, with your respect to David and others that are senior, will not always be a lawyer or a person of a legal background per se. It may well be a gentleman that I can think of, well, there's a number of senior, well-known arbitrators that have primary expertise in a field other than the law. They may well have got a law degree. Some of them haven't got law degrees, but their background in commerce means they're far better suited to the resolution of complicated programming issues or complicated engineering issues, because when they're dealing with expert witnesses talking about the issue, they have a background of knowledge in that area that assists them in the resolution of the dispute. So that when parties are involved in an arbitration proceeding, that we can be arguing about all manner of things, but one of the things I do encourage people to do when they're involved in an arbitration proceeding is at least agree about one thing, namely who you're going to appoint as an arbitrator. The next point I seek to make is in relation to moulding the process to suit the dispute. And in talking about moulding the process to suit the dispute, again, David made the point that in the old days, and I'll call it the old days, you had a situation where whilst they were called points of claim, really they were statements of claim, and you had points of defence and they were really defences in the usual sense. My experience in the recent past has been that arbitrators, again, are far more interested in identifying a way to resolve a dispute that will get to the heart of the dispute as fast as possible. So that, for instance, and some of the court rules now encapsulate this as well, for instance, instead of using pleadings, they use a Scott schedule. So that if there is a complicated technical issue, rather than having a pleading that runs through the usual way and has particulars and all the rest of it, they'll simply require that a party will identify in a Scott schedule form what the issue in dispute is, call up the basically in a compartmentalised way, and then the defendant or the respondent to the arbitration is required to provide a response in a scheduled form, so that we then very clearly have, instead of having an assertion in a statement of claim followed by a denial, you have an identification of the dispute and the technical response to the dispute, so that we get to the heart of the issue far quicker. And that leads on to an area in particular that is a real hobby horse of mine in terms of trying to get disputes resolved, whether they're being caught or in an arbitration context, and it probably comes out of my experience in running arbitrations. In an arbitration I did in 2004 before Mr. Jeff Markham, which ultimately resulted in proceedings being heard in the Supreme Court relating to my opponent sought to challenge the ultimate award of Mr. Markham, I first encountered the use of a hot tub or a conclaving process. To that point in time, I'd been involved in several arbitrations where there'd been expert witnesses about programming in particular, and expert witnesses about defects, where the evidence would be called and you'd cross-examine the witnesses for days on end, and you end up in a process where you had to make sure that you put all your propositions to their expert and vice versa, and the expert evidence might proceed over a space of 2 weeks. In the arbitration before Mr. Markham, he adopted the new procedure, which most of you may well be now familiar with in terms of conclaving and hot tubbing. We had two expert witnesses in relation to programming. The major issue and dispute there was a protracted dispute about delay. And if you've read the decisions of Justice Osborne in the Supreme Court in 2006, you'll see the major issue there was it related to the construction of the Liberty Tower on the corner of Spencer Street and Collins Street. The major issue and dispute there was my client, Abbey Group Contractors, was a little bit late according to the initial program in completing the works, but my client said it had encountered a number of delay events and therefore should be entitled to extensions of time. The major issue therefore was whether my client was entitled to the extensions of time. And what Mr. Markham did was to effectively set out an elaborate process whereby the expert reports were prepared, they were exchanged. He then got the witnesses together to produce a joint report, and that was all done outside the arbitration context. The joint report identified where the witnesses were in agreement and not in agreement, and that's all fairly common ground. That's the way it's done these days. But the beauty of what he then did was he made both of the witnesses sit in the witness box together. And instead of it being a process whereby barristers cross-examined the witnesses, he went through effectively the joint report that they'd prepared. And where there were differences between the witnesses, it involved effectively an inquisitorial type process where Mr. Markham asked questions and designed to elicit the differences of opinion. Both witnesses could hear what the other was saying, and obviously it needed him to control it, but both witnesses were able to say, put their contrary point of view, hear what the witnesses are saying, respectfully respond. And the process only took, ultimately an afternoon, my recollection, or better part of an afternoon, to go through about 8 or 9 extension of time claims. The result being that what we achieved in that arbitration was that whereas the arbitration, if it had been run in accordance with usual procedures, may well have occupied the better part of maybe 3 or 4 weeks, we got the whole thing resolved and a result after only 9 days of an arbitration. Now, I've been involved in several other cases. That one I've mentioned because all of what I've just told you is actually effectively recorded in the Supreme Court, so I can tell you about that one. I've been involved in several other ones that haven't ultimately got to court, which have been run very similar to that, and have ultimately resulted in, instead of having hearings that have run for weeks or months, I've had cases where they've been dealt with in sort of 2 and 3 days. And I would maintain, parties might argue that you can't hear disputes properly in 2 and 3 days. Well, I'm here to say that I think you can, that you need to be fairly careful in how you cut corners. But in my view, especially technical matters are best dealt with by adopting innovative solutions such as that I've identified that Mr. Markham did. In my paper on page 5, and I won't be able to identify the case because it relates to something that hasn't got before a court, but I've given you an example of how an arbitrator approached the issue of the resolution of a programming dispute in another building case last year. We had a situation where my client was seeking extensions of time, substantial extensions of time, to the completion of the construction of a hotel. There are programming experts for both parties who are identifying the competing positions of both parties. What the arbitrator in that case has proposed is that rather than parties actually file expert reports, that they provide him with, and he's made it very clear, that they're non-binding drafts of an expert report. In other words, effectively, the expert's preliminary position on the basis that the expert fully understands that that expert will not be bound by anything he says in the first report, but rather to give the arbitrator an indication as to what the expert may say based upon his present instructions at a hearing. The arbitrator then proposed that he would then meet with lawyers present, then meet with those experts, because quite often his concern was that quite often in programming areas you can have an expert approaching programming in one way and another expert approaching programming in another way, so that you have a situation where the experts actually don't join issue until they get in the witness box. His ambition there was to try and get them to properly join issue at the same level at the earliest possible opportunity. Now, in saying that, he recognised that the situation was that it may not end up being that the experts are proposed to approach the issue in the same way. However, the idea was that his idea is to get the experts together at an early stage to see whether they can at least agree the way they're going to approach the programming issue, and then once they've done that, to see whether or not they can agree various aspects. And so you end up with a situation where firstly, the approach to programming is agreed. Secondly, that as many of the intermediary issues are agreed, leaving the amount of dispute between the experts to a minimum. Now, at the moment, the procedure hasn't been finalised, but again, I think those of you that have been involved in building disputes will recognise that by adopting such a procedure, the prospect of it being a protracted argument about complicated programming issues is kept to a minimum. In that same arbitration, in relation to a defects issue, the arbitrator, we had expert evidence from about, and this has been referred to in the Tasmanian Supreme Court, we had expert evidence in relation to a defects issue which involved the building's, the expert witness in relation to tiling, some building surveyor experts, some architectural experts, and engineering experts, all in relation to the one defects issue. There were 8 or 9 expert witness statements on both sides. Now, again, 8 or 9 expert witness statements run in the traditional way. The evidence in relation to that and determination of the issue in relation to the defect that was identified would have taken potentially 8 or 9 days. The way the arbitrator did that, dealt with that issue in this case, was to deal with it on a preliminary basis, and I'll get to that in a moment. But the point I seek to make in relation to the receipt of expert evidence in that context is that the arbitrator sat them all around a table in the Law Institute of Tasmania, and over the space of an afternoon gave them the opportunity, effectively, again via a process of a joint report, went through all of the experts' evidence and got to a resolution of that dispute in the space of an afternoon by effectively hot-tubbing them all, giving them all an opportunity to be heard about all of the issues, and then coming to conclusion, obviously not on the same day, but shortly thereafter, in relation to an issue and dispute that was, the claim was over $1 million. So again, that's a further example of how using a flexible approach to the receipt of expert evidence results in great savings in time and economy in both legal time and executive time in running an arbitration proceeding, which I've referred to at page 5 of my paper to the decision of Justice Dixon in the Gunnison case. And obviously, we're all familiar with the fact that Justice Vicar in the tech list, that there's a barrister's CPD lecture that Justice Vicary gave, I think, a year or so ago about procedures of concurrent evidence and hot tubbing, and that the Supreme Court, I know, is now embracing that concept quite vigorously. But the processes I'm talking about sitting around a boardroom table and dealing with expert evidence in the way that I'm talking about, I don't think at this stage the Supreme Court is embracing to that extent, and certainly not the process I identified a bit earlier about having non-binding drafts of expert witness statements and approaching it in the flexible way that I was talking about. Now, the other aspect that I've touched upon in relation to the recent arbitration I was involved in Tasmania is the possibility of having a preliminary question or a stage proceeding or interim awards. Again, we have in the Supreme Court, and for that matter the Federal Court, there are procedures by which preliminary issues can be tried. I don't dispute that for a moment. Again, in the tech list, Justice Vicary has indicated an intention to deal with matters as much as possible in a procedure whereby preliminary questions might be considered. My experience over the last 10 years is somewhat different in the sense that when you do try and propose preliminary questions, and the courts have tended to still apply the procedures of that in the absence of preliminary questions, determining if not the entire proceeding but the majority of the proceeding, there has been an aversion to having a preliminary question, quite reasonably, in the sense that the courts have got limited time and limited resources, and the courts don't want to go down that path unless they're satisfied that what they're going to achieve may be a resolution of the proceedings. Compare that with what happened in the Tasmanian case I was involved in recently, where we had a situation where my client, the builder, had received certificates that hadn't been paid for a substantial amount of money. The superintendent then decided to certify in respect of a very substantial defect throughout the entirety of the hotel that would have had the result of a positive certificate in my client's favour turning into a significant negative certificate in the favour of the proprietor. Those of you that are familiar with building and construction standard form contracts know that under those contracts, various forms of performance guarantee are given, and would also be familiar with the whole body of law talking about the pulling of performance guarantees in circumstances where negative certificates are given. And one of the reasons why that sort of law exists is because we have situations where, for a variety of reasons, superintendents give negative certificates, either because projects are late or because the proprietor is suggesting that there is something wrong with the quality of work that has been done. In the Tasmanian case, if it had been a traditional proceeding before the Tasmanian Supreme Court, and I have recent experience of running a building case before the Tasmanian Supreme Court, with due respect to the Tasmanian Supreme Court, there would be no prospect of getting on a preliminary question in a Tasmanian court to deal with $1 million or $2 million alleged defect in the space of a month. and in the absence of that proceeding getting on to be able to show that, in fact, the defect didn't exist, my client would have been confronted with a situation where a positive certificate worth over $1 million was counteracted by a negative certificate in the vicinity of $2 million, resulting in a negative $1 million with the bank guarantee being pulled. Fortunately, that didn't happen. Because what we did was I persuaded the arbitrator that what he ought to do, even though it wouldn't resolve the proceeding, was to set down a preliminary determination of the defect in question. And we did that in the space of 2 weeks. And that was the procedure whereby I identified the fact that he basically got all the experts in that were giving evidence about the alleged tiling defect and had them sitting around the Law Institute table in the Tasmanian Law Institute. Everybody had an opportunity to express their opinion as to whether or not the defect in question was a defect. He heard all that evidence and everybody had the benefit of hearing what everybody else was saying. It involved the arbitrator being very careful as to how the evidence was given. He then gave a decision within the space of about 3 weeks. The consequence being, unfortunately we won, so that meant that a certificate that would have otherwise been very significantly negative ended up remaining positive in our favour. And the further consequence of that was, because the owner didn't get the negative certificate, our concerns were realised in the sense that a company called Hadley's has now gone into liquidation. That was the person who was seeking the negative certificate. So the beauty of what I'd been able to persuade the arbitrator to do was that whereas in a traditional context, the prospect was that my client's bank guarantee would have been pulled and Hadley's would have had the benefit of a $1 million bank guarantee. Rather, what happened was that the arbitrator determined the issue on a very quick basis and resulted in my client continuing to be entitled to the money, which therefore resulted in Hadley's having to appoint initially an administrator because it was, as it turned out, insolvent. And I prevented the fact that my client's bank guarantee was pulled in circumstances where we would have been in severe trouble had we not been able to persuade the arbitrator to find that the defect was not a defect, in fact, at all. Now, again, in the Victorian Supreme Court, it may well be that you can persuade Justice Vickery to do that now. Subsequently, in the Tasmanian Supreme Court, in another case where I was involved, running a standard court proceeding, my experience was such that where I tried to persuade the court to adopt a hot tubbing process, I tried to persuade the court to adopt a joint report process. In that case, for a variety of reasons, the court did not want to go down that path. So a case that could have been dealt with in the way that we dealt with the case before the arbitrator a few weeks before was set down to run for 8 weeks. And so it was a very similar style of case that was perfectly suited to the running of a hot tub, and the major issue in dispute was technical in the sense of engineering as to who was to blame for a defect in a structure. But the Tasmanian Supreme Court was not persuaded to adopt a contemporary approach, which was somewhat unfortunate. So the beauty of the arbitration procedure is thereby demonstrated, in my view, that and I am an advocate for it in the sense that the traditional court procedures have got a lot of benefits, but in the arbitration process you have the benefit of flexibility and the benefit of speed, which certainly in the building industry is what the clients are after. One of the other things that cause parties to balk at the arbitration process is the concept of cost. In my view, the concept of cost is not something that really should be taken into account anymore for two reasons. Firstly, if a more flexible approach to dispute resolution often results in the savings of cost because you don't have protracted court hearings. Secondly, in any event, my experience is now that in both the Supreme and Federal Court, once you get past a few days of hearing, you're paying effectively the same, if not more, than you would be paying for a day of an arbitrator's time. So that whereas maybe 10, 15 years ago, the fact you had to pay the arbitrator was a positive disincentive to the arbitration process, these days, cost really shouldn't come into the equation, because if you do adopt the flexible approach that I'm talking about, you do end up resulting in my view, substantial savings in costs, even though you are paying for the tribunal. The final point that I want to draw people's attention to, and this is an important point to keep in mind, is that in the context of building and construction disputes, and acting for plaintiffs in those disputes, people will know that one of the banes of their existence now is the existence of Part 4AA of the Wrongs Act. Often a plaintiff will say, well, I contracted with you, so I want to litigate with you and nobody else but you, because I've got a problem with the work that you did. Acting for the builder who's done the work, and as I regularly do, the defence that you get in a court proceeding quite often says, well, even if you are entitled to some damages against me, which I say that you're not, in any event, I identify a cast of thousands against whom you have a cause of action as well, and the owner then finds itself in a proceeding, whereas instead of fighting with its contracting party, it's also fighting with five or six or seven different subcontractors and specialist consultants and all manner of people that result in the proceeding becoming very protracted. Those of us that work in the building construction area know that there are many decisions that identify the fact that doesn't matter how hard you try and persuade a judge, if the person pleading on behalf of the defendant in that situation is sufficiently ingenious, it's impossible to be able to get those sorts of proceedings struck out until you get to trial. One of the benefits of in the arbitration context, and this picks up on a point that I think David first made in a paper, is that because of the contractual nature of an arbitration proceeding, Part 4AA of the Wrongs Act doesn't apply. So that one of the benefits of going to an arbitration is if you are satisfied that the party that you're litigating with is solvent, so that if you win, you'll get your money, then one of the benefits of doing that is that you avoid the prospect of having protracted proceedings by reason of the provisions of Part 4AA. Now, in saying that, obviously there is still the prospect that if the opposing party takes the view that there are other parties that ought to be involved in the proceedings, there are authorities, as people know, that say that in those circumstances they may say that the more appropriate forum is a court. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that that can necessarily be avoided. But having said that, starting point, if you commence an arbitration proceeding, you're on the front foot in terms of avoiding that multiplicity or that duplication of proceeding that is so often appears in litigation these days by reason of Part 4AA. What I've sought to do over the last 10 or 15 minutes is to give you a bit of a snapshot of what I've done over the last little while. I note the time is 8:45, but if people want to ask questions by reference to what I've been talking about, I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Michael. Just to watch this space issue on the proportionate liability, SCAG has considered whether the definition of court in the proportionate liability legislation that each state and territory has enacted should include expressly the word arbitrator to try to get around this problem of arbitrations not being subject to proportionate liability. It looks to be the pressure of the insurers who love proportionate liability because it releases them as representatives of the defendants from paying the full whack. It'll be interesting to see. My own view is I don't understand how changing the definition is going to make that legislation applicable in any event, but still. Any questions on either of those two papers at the back, sir?
One question. I don't practice in this area at all, so I'm not cold face, I'm not quite at the cold face yet. But I'd understood that for an arbitration board to oust the jurisdiction of the court so that you were compelled to have arbitration, you had to have Scott and Avery clause. Is that totally overridden by the new Arbitration Act in Victoria?
Yes, so long as it falls within the meaning of arbitration agreement under the Act. Yeah, some of the concepts of the 1984 legislation are now completely gone, and this primacy of the arbitration is is really buttressed under the provisions under this, under the new Act.
And could I ask one other question? In terms where the primary issue that might be the subject of arbitration clause is actually the meaning of a phrase, for example, overriding royalty, where there's almost, for example, two cases on that day in Australia, what regard will the arbitrator have to, in fact, decide cases in Australia, or will they go off on a frolic of their own and look at the meaning that commercial parties might
attribute to
the clause now? In other words, are they bound by prior judicial decisions on the meaning of phrases?
Just because you're in an arbitration context doesn't mean that I was talking about flexibility, but in that sort of environment, I would presume that the arbitrator you might pick might be a senior lawyer, maybe not, doesn't matter. But the court would expect them to apply the rule of law as in the same way as a Supreme Court or Federal Court judge would. And if they didn't, they'd then be subject to an appeal.
Yeah, even if for example, might have a vast range of, there might be not a consensus of meaning within industry, but you've got judicial decisions which are maybe 20, 30, 40 years old.
Well, the interpretation of a phrase will obviously have to have regard to the environment in which it operates, but they should have recourse to both prior determinations and also potentially the background matrix of facts if there is some kind of ambiguity, but there should be no relevant difference between the way a Supreme Court or Federal Court judge would approach the issue and the way the arbitrator would. Maybe the processes they adopt may be different to get to the result, but the conclusion should be the same. And in that sort of environment, it's a question of law, if the way that what you're talking about is a question of law.
Certainly
there's avenues if the arbitrator goes off on a frolic of their own to go to court.
But of course we're all mindful of the fact that it's increasingly difficult to get an appeal up successfully, particularly under the new Act.
Yes.
So, but that issue of overriding royalties, you would obviously, go to all those oil basin cases and so forth.
That's right.
Construction of a contract is commonly the issue before an arbitrator, and they would look to judicial authorities on how to construe the contract. It would be very rare that they would go completely mad. Other questions? In case anybody is interested in the hot tub approach of courts, which would be, of course, of influence if you were before an arbitrator trying to encourage an arbitrator unfamiliar with that approach to adopt it, because, of course, the court report is published. The Dura decision, D-U-R-A, of Justice Dixon of the 30th of March of this year was one where we had about five hot tubs in the trial. And there's, I would think, half of his 250-page judgment is relating to expert evidence and the admissibility of it, but also the process that he adopted in adjudicating the issues of expert evidence. So it might repay consideration. Also, preliminary questions, if I might comment on that. We all like to think that we can identify the key issue. The question is whether we have the courage to ditch everything else. And we rarely do, because we know that when you get to the high, they'll say, well, this is an obvious, the answer is absolutely plain as a pikestaff. It's the issue that nobody's seen until we saw it. But I did have a case many years ago against John Digby where Justice Byrne decided that we should have a preliminary issue, and he drafted the 10 questions. And it wasn't until the second day of what was intended to be a 3-day hearing that it was made plain to him that whatever the answer to the questions, it didn't matter to John's client. The case would go on. And so he
tossed it out with great criticism of counsel's approach to preliminary questions. But it is very difficult to sufficiently clarify the essential question and to ditch everything else. You've got to have a very courageous client. If you can do that, you could probably settle it outside the court. But anyway, that's the matter. The one final point I'd like to raise is a question that was perhaps touched on in Michael's paper. I think the approach of courts and the approach of arbitrators now in relation to expert evidence is to try to get to a position where common questions can be asked of all of those experts who are within a particular calling, so that you try to avoid this ships in the night syndrome that we've all experienced, which is so wasteful of time and money. That if you can, at an early stage, identify that each of the geotechs has got to address these five questions, their client can get them to address another 50 questions. That doesn't matter. But you must ensure that they're all addressing the first five questions. So the key issue at an early time is to get the adjudicator to a position where he can know enough about the case yet to run to be able to identify those questions. And that needs a lot of input from counsel. And perhaps those draft reports is one way of trying to get to that position where he is trying to understand more about the case without getting people to pin their colours to the mast, which is an interesting approach that I haven't heard of. Any questions? Final questions? Well, thank you very much. Can we just thank our lecturer?